22, tout monde, antenne, corps étrangers.
Hello. So, it's been a rather intense, no, not intense, it's been a rather long, epic journey that we've gone through since yesterday morning. And perhaps today, what I'm going to speak about, well, now at this moment, is going to somehow traverse quite a few things that we've already discussed. And I don't know, I was quite surprised at how many things kind of intercross in the end, in a kind of productive manner. But I was going to show a clip from a new Caribbean film, a film by the Caribbean Film Collective, but we don't have the file anymore, so I'm not going to show it. But that's cool because it's 6 o'clock, we're tired, people are going to come in and start eating cheese soon, so we're going to probably have to bouge. But instead, I'm also going to show anyway a 10-minute clip from a new film that I'm currently working on with a group of friends from Haiti and also Olivier Moana Mabeuf. And there's been a lot of talk about this word opacity. And it's spoken about recently quite a lot in various artistic kind of gestures and things. And I wanted to do like maybe just a mini trajectory, I suppose, of looking at some of its usages within certain critical theory. So first, I'm just going to speak about this one quote. It's in fact a quote that Philippa and I use in a text that we wrote together that accompanies a kind of reading, a live reading of our film, Sunstone. Normally I read it out, so I'm going to read it out, even though I don't generally like reading out what's on the screen because it seems a bit like a strange doublage. Transparency no longer seems like the bottom of the mirror in which Western humanity reflected the world in its own image. There is opacity now at the bottom of the mirror, a whole alluvium deposited by populations, silt that is fertile, but in actual fact, indistinct and unexplored even today, denied or insulted more often than not, and with an insistent presence that we are incapable of not experiencing. So I'm particularly drawn to this shiny quote. It's from Edouard Glissant from The Poetics of Relation. Oh, I did my own kind of collaging of opacity there. Some words have been made so opaque we can't read them. So we made some new poems there. Transparency, in fact, French language lacks an anchor. I think what gets explained in this, or not explained, but perhaps presented with this quote from Glissant from The Poetics of Relation, is precisely this idea how the European colonial project was based on something that Elizabeth Povinelli brought up recently in a series of three talks she gave in Paris about this idea that she discusses called embanking. And embanking, we can understand the embankment of a river, for example. So as a river goes in its course, it's dragging along pieces of earth, and it makes this makes these banks, which are made up from silt. So silt is this kind of earthly deposit that gets left behind when a river has kind of driven its course. And what Beth would argue, and what I found interesting, is that the European colonial project, for example, or all colonial projects, or in fact, or also in her case, looking at extractivism in Australia, is this idea of this permanent process of extracting resources from other lands and building up this kind of embankment, which then eventuates great riches in, let's say, in the instance of the European colonial project in Europe. Here, Glissant is also speaking about silt, and that silt is at the bottom of this mirror, the mirror in which Western humanity reflected the world in its own image. So we can understand, perhaps, this movement across the Atlantic from Europe towards the Caribbean as a movement that went forwards, but that was looking at itself in the mirror, which was quite nicely shown even earlier with the image that Rachel had in her film of a white colonial settler in Australia walking forwards, but with a mirror within which they can look at their own face. So they're going forwards, but they're always looking basically back at themselves. But Gleason argues that this can't continue now, because this violent process of embanking, of making embankments, has also produced this silt. So you don't just get the embankment that creates the riches for Europe, for example. You also get this surplus, this kind of waste that gets left over from processes of extraction, processes of mining, processes of fracking, processes of cultural extraction too. And this is what Gleason would try to argue is also this form of opacity. So it's this silt, this soil, this earth, that's this fertile matter, perhaps much like Philippa's archive material that she's been working with from Guinea-Bissau, also has this kind of sense of opacity behind it. The reason why I bring up this then about opacity and fertile silt as a form of kind of working against the embanking processes of a European colonial project. And I was going to show this clip from a film by the Caribbean Film Collective, because this was a conversation that Olivier and I had had with Beth at Kiasma a few weeks ago, within which we said to her, we kind of asked her whether she thought that the aesthetic approaches that the Caribbean Film Collective try and arrive at somehow creates a form of opaque. We were questioning whether or not they're using a particular kind of formal approaches within their cinematic practice, which I think could in many respects perhaps be argued to be a form of ciné marronnage, like Kojo said. Because Elizabeth brought up in one of her talks, and I'd mentioned this just yesterday, but how they try to use art against art. So they try to make films as a way to kind of reverse engineer the processes of embanking that art is also part of too. Art is also a process of embanking. There's, a cultural capital which can be embanked upon, can be extracted. And what Beth was trying to explain was that the work that they're trying to do with the Caribbean is, I had some quotes from her, but they're all so kind of confused now here, but she said how she says art is a form of, she says it's like a redirection machine. It's a way of redirecting these things, of, like I said, kind of reverse engineering the processes of a form of cultural embanking, also a form of economic embanking. Again, we could perhaps see that in the work of Philippa too, again with the film Spellreel, in which she shows this process that she went to Guinea-Bissau to show films that had been shot in the 1970s, 1960s in the War of Independence in Guinea-Bissau. And then Philippa ended up working with a group of people to digitize them and then made a form of mobile cinema that went around Guinea-Bissau in 2014 to show them to the people of Guinea-Bissau. Now, one of the things that came up in the talk the other day after the screening was that in fact, Philippa had received financing to make a feature film. But in fact, the financing for the feature film went into the archive, the processes of making this archival project happen, of digitizing the films, and then also bringing people to come and travel around Guinea-Bissau. So could we perhaps see that as a form of ciné marronnage? So to take money from an organization to produce a film for the cinema, with which you then reverse engineer, redirect those resources from a form of cultural and economic embanking to another source. So there's perhaps a process of opacity in some respects, of trying to remain opaque within a funding system that's itself deeply opaque and suspect, to try and push something against that to help the silt that is fertile continue to build up. And so then to bring that back to Caribbean, it's a similar thing I think that Beth was trying to say as well, is that there's, on the one hand, they try to do a form of economic re-embanking with the Caribbean Film Collective, but also an aesthetic re-embanking, and that they're trying to insert different aesthetic forms within a European canon of art practice, perhaps. Anyway, I can't show the film, so that's a shame. But the idea was that we would look at this this section for one of the films within which they treat the surface of the film itself with lots of different forms of layering and images. And then there's this character that keeps on asking a question to this other character who is recounting him stories from a kind of ancestral heritage from the Aboriginal people of the Northern Territories. And one of the characters says to him, is this true? He asks him 3 or 4 times in the film, is this true? And the other guy says, no, it was true once, but it's not true now, because we've lost all purposes now, or we've lost all possibilities. And when I saw that clip as well, and this came into the conversation with Beth about this question of opacity, was I said to her, is that not then a form of cultural opacity in the sense that these stories that are being transmitted are not perhaps available to be understood by everybody that's looking at them? I said to her, is this a form of a kind of aesthetic opacity within the nature of the stories that you're telling, that they're only available to be read by a certain kind of people? And Beth had said, well, no, that's not opacity. That's, in fact, really a form of transparency. But it's only transparent to those that know. It can only be understood by those that know. But I think I would still try and argue that that's a form of opacity in itself. Because in the fact that it's only available to those that know means that it somehow has a layer that is perhaps covering the meaning of those stories. I've got these very long quotes. This is from another text. I'm going to try and move on now into this other part of the talk, which will look at this idea then of what it means to do a form of transmission and transmutation of these stories that might exist within a specific cultural heritage, and the way in which they get tried, the stories are being told, but through this opaque layer that can only be understood perhaps by those that are taking part in that story or that take part within that particular culture. Or perhaps I didn't explain it very well with the Caribbean film, but maybe it will come up a bit clearer now when I try to talk about the project that I've been engaged with for the last few years now. I mean, we've more physically since the last year, but the work I've been doing in Haiti for the last, work around Haiti for the last few years. So initially I was in Haiti in 2016, and I met a group of young artists, particularly one called Rossi Jacques Cashmere, who became a good friend. And I'd said to him, I'm quite interested in making a film in your country, to which he replied, why? And we engaged already in this discussion about perhaps this process of cultural embanking. He was saying, what do you think you're going to be doing? And I said, well, I have an idea of doing something around perhaps a play, a theater play. And we discussed different plays that perhaps might be of interest. And one of them that came up was a play called Monsieur Toussaint, which was written by Edouard Glissant in 1961. This is a play about the last days in the life of Toussaint Louverture, who was one of the heads of the Haitian Revolution, one of the heads, one of the important figures for the Revolution of Haiti. I'm not going to go into the history of the Revolution of Haiti because that's going to probably be a long story to tell, but we can speak about it another day. When I discussed this play with my friend Rossi, and Rossi is he's a poet and a slammer and a rapper, and he's also just recently started getting more involved in theater. when I showed the play to him, he said to me, well, the problem is that it's in French. You know, how are we going to deal with this play within the country of Haiti if the play itself that attempts to speak about this history is in the language of the people that had already been hundreds of years of these processes of cultural and economic and banking? Yvon Glisson addresses it in the introduction of his book, of the play. He suggests that there is a problem in the fact that he wrote it in French, but he says that he wouldn't like to pretend to try and write it in Creole because he doesn't have enough of a grasp of Haitian Creole to write it in the language. But he said, I propose to somebody, to actors or theatre directors, to take this up as a possibility and to try and translate this into Creole. So Olivier and I went to Haiti in June 2017. We stayed there for 3 weeks, 2 weeks, with this artist, Rossi Jacques Cashmere. And he had put together a group of, including himself, 8 young Haitian actors, slammers, poets, rappers. And we started working on a translation of the play from French into Haitian Creole. Now, the other important thing for us to do was not, in fact, to just merely translate the play directly from French into Haitian Creole, but to actually translate the play in terms of its aesthetic form as well, to try and translate it from in terms of language, but also to translate it in time. The play is set in 1803, but it's written in 1961, and we were going to be performing it in 2017. So we started working on a process of long discussions with the group about what kind of elements we could introduce or subtract to try and make it into a contemporary piece of performance. The project ended up, I should have brought some photos to show you, but we ended up doing a performance of the play in downtown Port-au-Prince in a cemetery as part of the Ghetto Biennial in 2017. And then around the processes of putting this into practice, we started to make a film. So we've been filming the rehearsals. We filmed conversations between the actors where they discuss their different and differing and ever-changing opinions on the history of the revolution, its representation through philosophy and history and different forms of literature. And then we also started to build up with them a series of fictional scenes within which they would play the characters from the history of the Haitian Revolution themselves. So just to try and bring it back round again to this idea of transmission and transmutation, I'll just show you quickly some screenshots from a conversation just from the other day. So this is one of the members of the group. The group is called the Living and the Dead Ensemble. I didn't say that. And this is James at the top, James Desiris. He actually, this is quite interesting, whilst we were doing the play, James was also in the processes of becoming a voodoo priest. He's young, he's 22. And just after we left, over a 5-day period at Christmas, he became a voodoo priest. So he's someone that has a great body of knowledge about those religious practices, those ancestral heritages, in fact, within Haiti, but also its relationship that it has to the history of the revolution. So in the play, we have a series of songs that open the play. This was a thing that James had decided, the group actually in general decided was very important, was to foreground the importance of voodoo as a form of theatricality, but also as a form of embodied spirituality. So the play itself had to have a kind of structure, a space that was informed and formed by voodoo. So here, I had asked, can you translate who Vieux Silo is? He just says to me, Vieux Silo, c'est Loa. So Vieux Silo is just a god. And then he gave me the Haitian spelling, L-W-A, Loa. He didn't want to give me any more than that. But we discussed the other day, Vieux means old, And si l'eau must have some relationship to water. L'eau, de l'eau, water. I also asked him to translate the word habitation. I said it must mean habitation. And habitation in French just means a place in which we live, I suppose. It's a plantation as well. It's a farmland, no? He says, mais dans la réalité haïtienne, elle signifie un espace qui date de plusieurs années de génération en génération. In Haitian reality, it signifies a space that dates from years and from many years of from families of generations. And then Rossi replies, because it's strong as a song, and to try to translate it would kill the signification, and the songs will lose their sense. It should rest like that. To raise interest and doubts, to bring up doubts and questions, because then this started to come into the conversation. Should we not translate the songs for the people that are then going to see the play or see the film, so that they can understand what's being said? Now this comes back to the Caribbean Film Collective, and another thing that Beth had said the other day was that what they try to do insistently all the time is that they do not want to become, now this is, you're probably going to laugh when I say this because of precisely what I'm talking about, they don't want to become translators for the white settler colonists, because that's the processes they've been put through for years with anthropology, is that they are always treated as this kind of translators of their heritage. But the heritage, which with through rituals or certain processes, which for them is also part of an artistic practice. It's part of the heritage of their artwork, let's say. But for an anthropologist, it's seen as ritualistic. It's separated from art. It's part of religion. But nonetheless, it needs to have a form of translation to be understood. And they refuse to translate that. They decide to leave it as an opaque surface. That's my argument. Beth would say, no, it's transparent. But I would say, for me, looking in, it's an opaque surface. So similar questions started to come up with the group of Haitians. James then still replies, this is the greatest difficulty. We can't translate these songs because they're sacred. We would lose their essence in trying to translate them. Voodoo is an oral tradition. There we have James Rakiki, another person of the group, who says, no, we have to translate because we need to sell this work to this white audience because they need to get it and they need to give us money to do more work. And then at the end, Rossi replies saying, no, these songs should rest as the non-dit de l'histoire. They should stay as the unsaid, as the unspoken within history. So the fact is, here, what we were faced with is that these songs that open the play are very much understood as a form of transmission of a cultural heritage that has come across the ocean from West Africa to the Caribbean, that's been transported through the processes of forced migration of slavery, and that perhaps embedded within that oral tradition of the voodoo song that has now found a language it can speak through Haitian Creole, which was a language that was developed through the bringing together of many people from different parts of the African continent within one concentrated, confined space of the plantations of, in this instance, Haiti. But nonetheless, perhaps some of those secrets should remain within the language and within the songs and within these forms, and that those parts should be left untranslatable and should be left as a form of a kind of opaque gestural form that would rest transmissible and translucent to those that know and opaque to those that don't. And I think on that note, I'll just show a clip from the film. It's a 10-minute clip. The film is 2 hours. So I thought it wouldn't be good to show the whole thing. This is just a scene where the group are rehearsing by the ocean. It's a scene that probably lasts an hour and a half, but I've cut it down to 10 minutes. So none of the conversation makes sense. But you'll see.
C'est pas étranger mieux. Héritier, c'est pas étranger mieux. Au grand qu'à moins devant son bâti loyaux.
Tout ça. Vous songez, c'est l'île. À droite, c'était pour tout notre tête. Dans le fond, là, petit crasse, lumière frette. C'était l'hiver dans Jira. À gauche, t'es gué t'y cabanou. Bon, quoi de porte là, t'es gué un cheminé. Et devant, t'es gué une grosse chaise bien haut. Ou t'es toujours qu'on coque fou et peu à sous tête lui. En laissé l'île là, nous t'es quand même remarqué yon rempart avec yon tiguerite. Ou songez tout ça, bon papa me douce. Ou t'es toujours qu'on chita sous grosse chaise bien haut. Dans laissé ça, il te compte faire frette en pile. Songez gardien non? Manuel, mal millette, moitié paysan, moitié soldat. Où songez qu'on y a? Où songez?
Sorry for my rather confused, complicated prior introduction to all that. Could have just played it and then just asked questions. But basically, one thing I probably didn't say that's important was that, and that's where I'll just finish. We took the Gleeson play after a first decision between me and Rossi and Olivier to work on that and to try and translate it. We took the play, we cut it to pieces, we creolized it, and then now I'm in the process of trying to decode that creolization with the help of Jefte Carmil, my friend here, who's also acts in the film, but that's another part we'll talk about another day. And in the process of actually then trying to decipher the creolization of the Gleeson play, I kind of realized that actually they had changed the text almost entirely. Like nothing is left of the original Gleeson, which in many ways was the point from the beginning. We had said, how can we take Gleeson's literary kind of Caribbean bourgeoisie fascination, romanticization of Toussaint Louverture to Haiti to kind of tear it to pieces? Which was a desire of mine anyway, but it's so much more interesting that in the end, that desire of mine didn't go through of my own accord. It actually happened naturally with these guys anyway. That's how they kind of went to the text. That was their first approach. And now the new proposition has come up for when we go back in July to shoot some final scenes, is to actually we're going to do it, maybe. We're going to burn. I know burning books here in Europe has a specific heritage, but in Haiti it doesn't mean the same thing. So we're going to do, we're going to tear pages out of the Gleeson book and kind of do a sacrificial ritual of Monsieur Toussaint by Gleeson. Anyway, there I'm going to try and end, but I'm happy to answer questions. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Louis, for this small. I mean, I missed a lot. What you showed in Doc's Kingdom of like the process of translating. That I think it's you have this like labor of like recoding actually, and I think this notion of recoding is actually a notion that is very interesting. In the context of Paulo Freire, because Paulo Freire actually developed all this pedagogical process and the pedagogy of the oppressed, you know, something that I think many people know about it. But one of the issues that he raised a lot, it was this idea that you can only learn through a kind of a recoding of words through your own situated. So through your own situation and how, and you also talked. I mean, Paulo Freire talked about something that could be actually related to, what I think it could be related to the concept of opacity of Gleeson. That is actually the idea of tolerance. That is not so much about opacity as this thing that is not accessible to someone, but and accessible to others. As you put it in this kind of dichotomy, I don't know if it's so much about this kind of dichotomy, but it's more about to be able to access a dimension of tolerance towards what you don't understand or what you cannot completely canonically decode. But eventually, there's all kinds of other ways of receiving, you know, information. That so I'm not so much interested in this kind of those that. Can access those who cannot access, but maybe there is a third way of being there. So many ideas. But I don't know. I just before I actually wanted to make a comment that I didn't make that maybe I just bringing up here because it's just it was just a thought about a small story that came from. I mean, because we did in August we did this Doc's Kingdom seminar that. resonates a lot with this, with Black Lenses, that is the surfacing trouble. And after we finished the seminar that actually ended with also with Angelica showing Hydro Decapter, and how there was an event, like a natural event, that was the Irma hurricane just beat Cuba, I think, at that time, in the beginning of September. The hurricane Irma just catched the Cuba and then entered Miami. And funny enough, after our seminar, I went to Miami, and Jean Moreno, and we were looking at the news, and Jean Moreno showed me, that is this curator in Miami, we were looking at the news, and there was this track, this path of the hurricane, and the hurricane was actually doing the track, like this graphic was doing the track of the hurricane. It was coming exactly from Guinea-Bissau, going through Cape Verde and hitting Cuba, and making exactly this path, you know, that we have been like talking for a whole week. And it made me think about also this idea of like coming back to this kind of script and this kind of code, that maybe it is there in nature and in water, that and also in the forces of the nature, that actually is a script that we always separated, you know, like from putting. I mean, I think that we should convoke all these issues to think about history and think about what kind of forces are we entangled, because I think. And then Jean said, but all the storms start exactly there and come to us. So it's exactly the path, you know, of the slave ship. It's exactly the path of the underwater cables, you know, that connect internet and so I was thinking that there is I mean, just a general thought, that there is this kind of all this you know, score of the nature that that we are not connected, that there is other cultures that are connected with, but we disconnected somehow, and they put it always as in another like scientific dimension. Just this was just a comment, but maybe you could.
I would like just to add something really quickly, just to also talk about what Erika, Anjali, and Kodjo talk about the issue of the representation. I think, of course, we can say it's really difficult to represent something, but I think the non-representation can be just a global solution. It depends really on the context. And in that case, I think something super interesting happened within the representation. I talked the first day about the fact we can hide ourselves in light. And so Louis came with that fear of peace, and we are together in July, and last July, the first time. Just the purpose of that was to try to represent some young generation trying to play that play, convoking in certain way a ghost. It was a really short idea, and it was a shooting. We met them, we make a workshop, we shoot, and the curator of the Ghetto Biennial, she passed by and she saw the rehearsals. She said, I want that piece. But it was not that piece, it was just a rehearsal to make the shooting. You know, it was a kind of fake thing, I have to say, a certain way. So it was a representation, and it was not the good way. So that woman said, I want the world piece. So we've been back in November and worked for 3-4 weeks to create a kind of piece, which is the half of the book, let's say. And we play that piece with the public of Port-au-Prince in the Port-au-Prince Cemetery at night with torch and walking in the cemetery. And so what happened with the translation happened also with the project itself. It came out from a simple representation and came something happened for real. And people, they're translating with the languages, but they're translating also in a performing way. So they take all the history in their body, and they play it in night. Imagine you are in the cemetery of Port-au-Prince, which is a totally incredible place, but you ask to people to come, you know, with torch at night, And so only with the light of torch we played that play. It was totally incredible, and it was totally over our desire, but not over because it's more. It's somewhere else. So that representation that you can, which is not a projection, become again something as a ritual that you can desire, and you can only see if you are in. Ask that question of opacity to be in a situation. So it was not possible to have that projection because we didn't know the place, we didn't know the capacity of doing that. And finally said, okay, let's make it for real. So finally the project also of rehearse and making the piece for real become not a representation in the sense that we have to make a picture of something. And so finally, for them play something, it's something more than represent something. Playing is transform yourself in something. And so we will really work with them with the fact that they absorb the characters of the piece. They absorb it. And so it's a process which is over the representation, finally. We will make a kind of film with that, but something happened is something that is close to what you try to do with Hydra Decapita. But in certain way, with a presence of body, but not the kind of body that we imagine to represent at that moment. Another kind of body which become encrypted in certain way.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe, could you put the Moten text back up? It's good to think, right?
Yeah, because
that text you just had.
That's
just
what I was supposed to go to, but I just was so
just
confused
leave it up
and
there.
Baffled that I just didn't really get time to do it.
It's just great. It's good to.
Because I've got the Hartman bit that he references too. But anyway, yeah.
But just following on from Olivier's point there, you know, maybe between representation and presentation is study, which cuts across both. And it sounds like the shoot was simultaneously a study process.
Yeah.
You know, the distinctions between rehearsing, speaking, reading, discussing, you know, in a way, all of these are modalities of study, you know. And, you know, what you showed us of Ouverture is really quite compelling. But could you say a bit more about having gone through this process of creolizing Glisson, when you say you're now embarking on a question of decoding, do you mean decoding? You don't mean decoding only in terms of editing, or how do you understand decoding there? Because it sounds as if the work is already accomplished,
yeah,
in a way that ran out of, in a way that exceeded and deviated from your intention and your control. Yeah. So in a way, what's the need for decoding? If, you know, maybe that line, you know, the line that Olivier started with, Moten and Harney say, some people want to run things, some things want to run. You know, so something has run away, right?
So let it run away, yeah.
Yeah, some things have run away, which is different from some people wanting to run things, you know.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, but basically, you know, what happened in many respects is that we set out to try and make this film, right? And then the film or the project kind of escaped us. And that was amazing. And we didn't, and also what's doubly interesting with that the project escaped us was kind of written in the project, because the project is about, because something I didn't explain too that's really important, it's Louverture who's in a prison, right? And the prison is represented by Glisson in the play as a kind of ship, as a slave ship. And the prison was in the Jura Ocean, in the Jura Mountains, that was once a tropical ocean 10 or 100 billion years ago. So Glisson's a good geologist in that he knows that the Jura was in fact an ocean before it became a mountain. So he makes the prison the slave ship. And in this slave ship, Louverture is visited continuously by the ghosts of maroon slaves. Well, by one specific one who Jephthé began the whole conference with, Macandal. who's this famous Maroon figure. So we set out to try and make a work that would perhaps also understand Louverture as a prisoner, but is himself trying to go through the processes of a form of marronage through the ghostly visits of these ancestors from Haiti. And when we get there to try and do the work, like I say, this idea of the escape is already written in the project itself. So when we get there, of course it escapes us. And that's a beautiful moment. And that's when we decide for the work to then continue. And like you said, to let that escape continue to run. So then how to come back, or why then this necessity of the decoding? This is the problem that gets posed now, because the film then, like, how do we understand to represent the film itself? And just to make it really basic, why it has to be decoded is because in some respects, you know, this sequence here, we still nonetheless need a certain level of translation in that we need subtitles, for example. So then the question is, I mean, that's so base to bring it down to that, but that's what it was. That's why Jeff Day and I sat for a whole day together, 2 days together, play, pause, play, pause, play, pause, to try and now, because I could have just taken the Louverture play. I've got the English translation here by J. Michael Dash. I could just go to scene 5, you know, act 4, and I would just type out my subtitles. But I knew that what they had done was not this, because the project had escaped us. So it wasn't a method of trying to catch that escapee, but it was trying to understand. So the processes of decoding now is not in montage, it's just simply a question of subtitling, because as much as we need perhaps to respect that right of opacity that the creolization process brings, it needs to be rendered somewhat, it has to communicate somehow. But then that's the question, maybe we leave it unsubtitled, and the people don't understand. I mean, that was the other question too for tonight, was just to watch the gestures, the bodies, and people understand. You understand what's being said without understanding at the same time. But anyway, yeah, Rachel, question, sorry.
Yeah, this is an epic conversation, but two things. I think it's really dangerous to read Glissant, and I'm not a Glissant reader, okay? So I'm terrible with his archive because I've only read like 2 texts, but coming from like a critical digital cultural perspective, you know, it's not a post-internet theory of language, right? So that there isn't this like binary on-off informatic philosophy of culture in Glissant, I'm pretty sure. And I think this, I think it's actually really unfortunate that we had to move from Pavanelli to Haiti, because, you know, the situation of their amazing practice comes out of the necessity to still have an anthropologist represent you in court for a land claim. Like, that's the history of the way that she gets into that relationship, is because she wants to contribute to, you know, in a long duration to their survival, practice, culture, inseparable. And this is a labor question, right? So I always say, when people, like, using these kinds of models of like double practices of collaboration, where the anthropologist is giving the license to produce a certain kind of relation in a totally other context, I think it's really tough. I think it's really problematic. I know that that's just because they were supposed to be playing now, and then you're moving into a different. So that, I know that that's not deliberate as a programming thing, but it's Haiti, right? And so, you know, it's, you know, their context is like the opposite of a revolutionary context.
Yeah, yeah.
The second thing I was going to say is. No, I don't mean that. But the text, you know, the text that you're interested in, like, I'm just saying it's really hard to go really quickly between those two spaces, yeah, using the anthropological strategy with Carabing as a generalizable model, yeah. And I'm not saying you're doing that, but I'm just, like, you know, I'm just pointing to that. as a question, but also, you know, when people ask me how they can do more in relation, in as cultural production in relationship to Aboriginal Australia, I'm, you know, the first thing I say is that, you know, they will curate you. Like, if you turn up to the scene and figure out what the relationship is that can be produced, you know, the difference between what your idea was in the original format and what it becomes is always two different things, right? And I, you know, there's a level of ambition in your work that I probably will never have because I'm way too sensitive to these kinds of problematics. But the notion that there will be a kind of resolution of transparency, or that there will be an experience in which, you know, those, your team of production has the same experience as their team. You know, it's always a, you know what I mean? It's always a dance, you know, at best. But also, yeah, I just think that this kind of question of duration at the level of labor, I think, is a really inseparable from an investment in the culture of translation, something like that.
I don't know if I can just, I think it's not a question, so there's no answer, but I think perhaps talking about the process with the Haitian group is to create a kind of permanent collaboration for long term, as we create everywhere we were, even in here in Paris with Kiasma, it's 70 years making that same fucking thing and same place. And so with the Haitian people, the perspective of time is a certain way, never long, because, you know, there's people that are really artists of living situation. But in a certain way, they long too. It has to be long, but it has to be quick too. They have been a certain way quicker than us, because we were slower to do, okay, let's try, let's work like that, let's try just to do that and to be sure that we don't make any mistake. But for them, okay, guy, we have to, and so that transformation of the text is also the speed that they are living in. They need things happen, and things happen now and quickly with concrete consequences. For example, open a time of rehearsals with them. That means that you're going to play the play really soon.
Sorry, I really am not commenting on the practice. I'm commenting on the juxtaposition. But also, just for the sake of being really clear, you know, in this time of like extreme extractivism in Australia, Caribbing is the main artist group that's visiting Europe from Australia to be the Aboriginal artists, right? And this is not your problem. That's not your problem at all. But when they're taken as the mode of production, because they're the translation aspect between the anthropologist and the, you know, the more remote Aboriginal community, you know, the reduction of the contemporary cultural practice of Aboriginal, you know, contemporary film and art, you know, gets reduced to that model. That's what I'm being sensitive to, and it's nothing that you're doing wrong, right? But just for the sake of my explaining my anxiety, I get very sensitive about seeing Caribbing as the model of Australian contemporary film production, right? Because so many more artists need to be visible from there for how they deal with this question in so many different ways. And that, like, you know, for the sake of making that public, I know that, you know, they get their, I just think they're remarkable, but there's so many more remarkable artists doing very different kinds of practices from a very diverse kind of contemporary scene. So that's all I'm kind of commenting on.
Thank you. You say a last word, because I think we're over time, and people of La Colonia have been super smart with us, because we're over than 1 hour. So Louis, you want to say a last thing?
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
So I will say myself. You want to say something, Emma?
No.
So I will thank you first, Louis, and first for the sharing of that expert. Thank you. And I would like to thank all the speakers of all those days, the great Kiasma team, and everybody worked to make that incredible event happen. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you to La Colonie, to Kader, and everybody. And thank you very much.